Leffler versus Leffler. Judge Pirtle is recused on this one. Judge Moore will be participating on briefs. So we can proceed with that one.
We're the only whole act today.
Not quite whole.
May I proceed?
You may.
May it please the court, the issue in this case is really one that requires that we talk about the facts of a case in which my client contends that he owns an undivided one-half interest in the farm that's been in the Leffler family for decades. My client is Lawrence Leffler. He paid for 50% of this farm. His brother contends that he loaned his brother 50% of the money. So we need to evaluate the evidence to see what makes sense in that context. Your standard of review is interesting because the standard of review ordinarily leaves room for you to engage in some deference for the findings of the trial court. But at least as expressed on its face in Judge Castle's recent opinions in constructive and resulting trust cases, that's not so. You're supposed to make this decision on your own without deference to the trial court. So with or without it, I want to talk about the evidence and what does or does not make sense.
Well, before you move on to that, let me just ask you, in reading the opinion, can we tell, did the judge even make credibility findings?
Well, she made one, and that involved the interrogatory answers of the co-plaintiff, Patricia Leffler. Beyond that, mm-hmm. Your Honor, I don't think she made credibility yep. findings. But she just adopted one version of the facts. Okay. So the version of the facts for which I argue is essentially this. In part, it relies on my client's testimony, but only in a little bitty part. That little bitty part is my client's assertion that on the day of closing, he paid half of the down payment. That's really the end of what you have to believe, and you don't even have to accept that from Lawrence to accept and rule for his side of the case, because Robert admits that the investments of the two brothers were equal, including the original down payment.
Well, doesn't he deny receiving half payment?
He does, but his ledgers show that they balanced, and he testified that their investments were equal. He just disputed whether his brother's investment, my client's investment, was a loan to him or an investment in the farm, but he admits the amounts were equal.
The ledger doesn't reflect a 50% down payment from your client, though, does it?
I think it does, and it took me a while to find it, and I'm sorry I can't give you the page number right now, but it's either,
unlike you.
It's either the last page or the second to last page, I believe, if I remember it correctly. And I'm looking at the picture in my mind of the page that I perceive, and I think it's in the upper fourth of the page where there's a reference that at least equalizes it from the beginning. I don't think it refers to the down payment in those words. There is nothing in the record, including in Robert's testimony, that is consistent with the loan theory. There's no promissory note. There's no balance due. Robert couldn't describe the amount owed at trial. There's no set-aside of funds. There was no interest rate agreed upon. There were no payments made. None of the entries in Robert's ledger, made year after year over 16 years, reflect a balance due on a loan. None refer to a loan. All refer to equalizing payments, either by using the divide by two sign or by using the word apiece, both of which points were admitted by Robert in his testimony. He repeatedly said, we equalized, we equalized, we equalized. Ah, but Larry was just making a loan to me. No evidence of that. There is evidence that Larry made a loan in the family, and that loan was to his mother. It was documented. It had an interest rate. It had payments regularly booked, recorded, and finally paid in full after her death from the estate. So the behavior of the parties is consistent with Larry's view, inconsistent with Robert's claim, and Robert has nothing to substantiate his view.
We have Marla's testimony in which she indicates that Larry told her he was loaning. the money.
That's true. She wasn't clear about whether that was the loan to Mother or the loan to Robert. She just said she knew that there was a loan involved. And her testimony was belated on that point and also without substantiation. She referred generally to a gathering of the family, and that was it. Of course, Larry denies that, and so we have a sister saying one thing, a brother saying another, and nothing to support one view. The logic of this case is on Larry's side. You might start with the premise, well, if you're going to buy a 50% interest in the farm, you'd better take title of record. But once you're past that premise, recognizing I'm doing business with my brother, he doesn't want to be in business with my wife if I die. He just went through a divorce that was settled the same month this farm was purchased. That's Robert who went through the divorce. Larry says, okay, I trust you. You can hold title. Thereafter, for the first 12 years they had this farm, it was cash rented. Neither brother had any active involvement in it unless it was to clean up trees after a windstorm or do a little minor work on the outbuildings, which were of minimal quality. After that, the farm gets divided 50-50. Larry says, let's put half of it in the government program. And Robert says, well, I don't want to do that with all of it. I want to farm half of it. So Robert farms half. The other half goes into the government program. There's just nothing here that suggests that this is other than a classic resulting trust case. It's hard to imagine a better one in which the evidence is anything other than somebody standing up and saying, oh yeah, we intended a resulting trust, and there's an admission on the record.
Let me stop you right there because you used the term resulting trust. At trial, it appeared, and in your pleading, it appeared you were proceeding on a constructive trust theory. Does Dreesen do away with that theory?
With the theory of a resulting trust?
No, of a constructive trust.
No, but it erases the artificial difference between the words. I think it's pretty clear from a look at the restatement third of trust and some other authorities cited in my brief that a resulting trust is a form of constructive trust.
But a constructive trust requires the fraud part, whereas the resulting trust does not.
And
right?
The difference between the two is that the resulting trust involves a change of mind. So the constructive trust requires the fraud at the outset. The resulting trust's fraud occurs when what starts out as a legitimate agreement is reneged upon during the course of performance. So the trust isn't one that existed at the beginning. It came into existence during the course of whatever the activity involved is in the case. In this case, Larry contends that when they bought the farm, Robert did in fact agree to hold title for him. There was no fraud. But when Robert changed his mind, the fraud occurred. That's why the result of the subsequent change is a resulting trust.
Okay. So resulting trust, not constructive trust, to the extent there's a difference between the two, right?
I think so.
Just want to know my analytical framework.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I also think that, frankly, we would probably do well to do away with the distinction between the terms and just recognize that for a constructive trust or for an implied contract, which is what that is, to arise, the fraud or the deception can either occur at the beginning or during the course of performance. The outcome under the law is the same, and that is to impose a trust on the circumstances to assure that there isn't an unjust result. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Tricker. I represent the appellee and cross-appellant, Mr. Robert Loeffler. You may hear me refer to him as Bob. He goes by Bob also. Mr. Robert Loeffler believes that the district court was correct in its finding, and he respectfully requests that this honorable court affirm the judgment of the district court. A resulting trust is one that it was presumed to have always been contemplated by the court. And the burden is on the appellant here, and it's a clear and convincing standard. And the clear and convincing standard is one that the court, the Supreme Court of Nebraska, has defined as being that amount of evidence which produces in the trier of fact a firm belief or conviction the existence of a fact to be proved. This is higher than the preponderance of the evidence standard. It's lower than beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's a very high standard that Mr. Larry Loeffler was required to prove at the trial of this matter, and he did not prove it. Mr. Larry Loeffler failed to show by clear and convincing evidence that this resulting trust was created. One of the things that we just heard appellant's counsel discuss was that Mr. Lawrence Loeffler paid half of the down payment for the purchase of his property. He did not do that. Mr. Robert Loeffler has testified that he paid the entire $10,000 down payment. There is no written record to indicate that anything was paid by Lawrence Loeffler. He has no receipts, no canceled checks, no proof that he went to the bank and pulled $5,000 out. In fact, he was impeached at trial on this issue. When he was deposed, he was asked, how did you pay this? How did you pay your half of the down payment? He says, I don't know. I can't tell you. And then at trial, he suddenly remembered that he paid cash. Also at his deposition, when asked whether he gave Bob this $5,000 prior to that July 31st, 1999 purchase, he responded, I can't answer that. But then at trial, he remembers that, oh, I gave that cash to him within days of closing. So he couldn't testify how he paid it when he was deposed on the issue, and he couldn't tell us when he made it, and these memories came back to him at trial. So when we look at the clear and convincing standard, he has not proven to a trier of fact that he paid that $5,000 at the purchase of the property. In fact, all the documents that we have from that purchase show that Robert Loeffler purchased the property. We have the warranty deed. We have the promissory note. He's the only guarantor on that. All of the documents were stipulated Robert Loeffler was the purchaser of that property.
But wouldn't that be true in any resulting trust or constructive trust? I mean, that's the essence of it. His name's not on the documents, right?
Sure. But the documents, one would assume, as the Dressing Coat Court discussed with the constructive trust, that when one doesn't argue that their name is not on those documents, that that's one way of understanding that they aren't an owner. But in the end, it's appellant's duty to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he made this payment. He has no ledger. He has nothing. In fact, when we think about ledgers, the ledger that we keep talking about is Mr. Robert Loeffler's ledger that he kept as the owner of the farm. Mr. Lawrence Loeffler has no ledger. If he's a half owner of this parcel of land, where are his documents?
Well, isn't he getting annual reviews of the financial documents?
No. Mr. Robert Loeffler testified that he was not providing any sort of documents to Larry every year. There was one time he sent the tax records because mother requested it, and there was a time when he sent a ledger when Larry requested it towards the end when they were trying to reach a settlement on this. But no, Robert Loeffler testified that he did not send an accounting every year. And again, clear and convincing evidence, Mr. Larry Loeffler hasn't provided those as evidence, you know, that I received each of these every year. He didn't receive any. He was not an owner of this property.
What about the significance of it being 50-50? Doesn't that start to lend itself to being a half owner? Or did they somehow agree, I'm just going to loan you 50% of the value of this over time? I mean, what's the sense of that?
The loan occurred, and Mr. Robert Loeffler testified to this at trial. When mom was selling him the land, she had some worries that if he had these deficit years, would one of his brothers help him with loans during the deficit years? One of his brothers, Mr. Robert Loeffler testified, was unable to do that for him. Mr. Lawrence Loeffler said that he would help in those years and pay half the deficit. So this was a request of their mother. It's something mom wanted to keep this farm in the family, and it's what she requested that her boys do, and that's how they did it. And that's how they set it up.
So now you just made a reference to her boys. Don't we have some evidence of her boys?
Yes.
In the record?
Yes, there is there's a couple of documents. One of them says sold to Bob. Bob purchased one of those documents. And there's also a letter that she said sold to
when the boys bought the farm.
Boys bought the farm. And Marla testified that and Bob also testified that she often referred to Bob and his son BJ, Robert Jr., as the boys. So even though Robert purchased the farm, he testified, and it was always the belief that he's going to farm it, and then BJ will have it. And it's their farm. And you know, BJ's now an adult, and they've been farming it for 20 years together.
Can I want to direct your attention just for a minute to the district court's order Would you agree with me that the reason the court rejected the resulting trust is because it found it couldn't withstand the statute of frauds?
That is how the order read.
Would you agree that's incorrect?
Well, I would agree that that's not the reason that I think it doesn't withstand on its own. So the same facts, that we can look at the facts here and the clear and convincing evidence standard. And this, again, this will not rise to this. The appellant hasn't reached the standard of clear and convincing evidence. So what I think the judge was getting at is that this appears to be sort of a, if there was anything here, it was if there was any sort of agreement, there's a verbal agreement for the purchase of real estate, which doesn't withstand the statute of frauds. And we have appellant here making this argument to sort of backdoor in, trying to find a way to wiggle out of the fact that because of the statute of frauds and because of the statute of limitations issues, he's trying to make it an equitable argument. I think that might be where the court was going with that.
Would you agree that the statute of frauds is not a defense to a resulting trust?
I agree theory. With that.
Okay.
I agree with that. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
So, switching again back to the facts, we got two completely different stories.
Yes.
I mean, between the brothers. The January 18, 2018 email from Robert to Larry. So there's that exchange of emails between the two of them about maybe the purchasing of the property or whatever, and Bob, I think, starts that email with something like, there's a few things I want to clear up. But one of the things he never attempts to clear up is that there was a partnership between the two of them in that email.
Yes, and Bob testified to that at the trial of the matter. They had already gone through that. They had been discussing this for a while and discussing their dispute on that. So if you look at there's a January 16, 2018 email from Larry to Bob, when Larry's saying, I'm open to suggestions on how to come to a settlement. And that is viewed by Robert that they were in a disagreement. Bob testified he never wanted to go to court on this. It's very hard on their family, as you can imagine. And so Bob was looking to try and end this without me having to be here today, frankly. So that is where that was coming from. One thing I would like to point out to this court is that Mr. Lawrence Loeffler has affirmatively, basically admitted during the course of these last 20 years that he didn't own this property. First thing is Mr. Lawrence Loeffler was divorced in 2006. During his divorce proceeding, when he was to tell the divorce court what he had for assets and liabilities during a typical dissolution, he did not list this farm as an asset or a liability on his property ownership, and he admitted to that.
Well, I mean, wasn't that part of the reason his name wasn't going to go on there? Because he didn't want his wife to know about it? So if that were part of the reason, I'm not justifying it. I'm just explaining I'm trying to figure out the reason. If his goal was to keep Patricia from knowing about it, it's probably not an asset he would disclose.
Well, I suppose he's trying to have his cake and eat it too then. Because at this point, was dishonest with that court? Or was he dishonest with our district court here in this lawsuit? I don't know, but the standard is clear and convincing evidence, and it's his burden. He also had a bank loan he bought an acreage after his divorce, 7 years after his divorce, and when asked whether he listed on that financial statement for that mortgage, this farm as an asset or a liability on his financial statements, he said no. So that was after his divorce with Patricia, and he's still not telling the bank that this is something that he owns or there could be a liability on, and he didn't tell the divorce court on this. So, but he's telling the district court in Nebraska that he does own it. I mean, he's just going back and forth, and he's looking for a way to get his hands on his brother's farm that finally started turning a profit in that 2013 year, right around the time Mom, the seller, died. They go into the CRP land that Bob managed. Bob lined him up for the CRP. Bob got the seed for the CRP. Well, he planted the seed. He drilled for the seed. He's been building up cofferdams on the property by himself since then. He's been doing all the work on it. And then Mom dies, and then Brother Lawrence comes in and says, hey, I'm half owner of that property. Where's he been for 15, 20 years? He hasn't been helping in the way that one would expect an owner. He hasn't been keeping books like an owner should keep books. He hasn't been doing anything as an owner should. He's been loaning his brother some money every year to half the deficit on the farm. That's it. And it's his burden. It's Lawrence's burden to prove that he was an owner. And he just simply hasn't done that.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
How much time does Mr. Domina have left?
1 minute and 33 seconds, Your Honor.
Your Honor, first of all, Patricia Leffler knew about the farm. That's her testimony in her interrogatory answer. There was never an attempt to take her deposition, to inquire of the lawyers involved in the divorce case, or in any way to raise an issue about whether that interrogatory answer was true. To suggest that there was a fraud committed on the South Dakota court is false. The two parties to that divorce case didn't duke it out like the records you have to read and fight your way through in case after case. They had an amicable divorce, and they got it over with. The second thing is, Larry does have the burden of proof. He doesn't shrink from it. He stands straight up to it and says, here is what I have from my brother that proves that my position is correct. My brother says we invested equally. My brother says we equalized. My brother says you are equal in one of the entries, not you've loaned as much as I've invested. That's not what happened. The email communications are an attempt to agree on a per acre value so one of them can sell out to the other. It's a classic trust case, resulting trust. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. All right, thank you. The case is submitted and counsel is excused.